need to just sit down now. That introduction. I'm C.D. Collins, an alcoholic from Statesboro, Georgia. Been sober since October the 21st, 1957. I don't know whether y'all know or not, but Statesboro, Georgia is the AA capital of the world per capita. 20,000 people. We have 6 AA groups. We have 68 meetings a week in our town. It's a status symbol to be in AA more than it is a country club, but a rotary club, but a signal. Now, Cornel knows that. This guy here, I knew him in way back. And now I can't tell the real story, because Virginia's here, and she'd get terribly upset. We might shoot me. I don't know. But he's my friend and has been, and thank God for him today, because he and a fellow by the name of Bob Fowler, the one that came on board, we got AA started in Statesboro, Georgia, and they're the ones that were responsible for the group going in. They would leave their job in the middle of the day and come to Statesboro, Georgia, see about us four drunks who were trying to stay sober. And it got it started there. We drove back to the Savannah for many years, drove back to Augusta, Georgia, thought absolutely nothing of driving 200 miles on a night to go to an AA meeting. Now, think about what I'm saying. I hope, pray to God, I touch somebody here in this group about what I'm saying. And to say again to you, I've missed my kickoff in it. Steve, tell you, it's an honor to be asked to talk here. I thank God I feel unable to do exactly what I'm supposed to do, but I'm going to do the best I can today. But to tell y'all, it's an honor. Y'all do everything first class. Y'all got something going here that good Lord willing, I'm going to be back next year here and see this deal, because it's wonderful. But to get involved in the program and do what it said, do some most amazing things. A lot of people think miracles were performed 2,000 years ago when Christ walked to earth. They're still being performed today before your very eyes. I've seen them occur. I'm a walking miracle. I am. Cornelia is a walking miracle, you know. Good Lord smiled on us. I lost everything in the world as a result of drinking. I was raised up in South Georgia town now on a one-horse farm. I don't know, sometimes I get things. I raised up on this one-horse farm. My grandfather had 13 children, and as every one of them married, he gave them a one-horse farm as a mule and a buggy and a wagon and a house and all that. And I grew up on this thing. And I grew up going to Old Line Primitive Baptist. I hope some of y'all can identify Old Line Primitive Baptist Church, where they preached that hellfire and damnation. And they had the minister to come around in a mule and wagon. They built a little brush arbor, and then they had a lantern up there, and they preached this hellfire stuff all the time. And I had to go with my mom and daddy, and they preached this thing, you're going to burn in hell forever if you do certain things. You don't die, you burn forever. Now think about what I'm saying. You burn forever. Hell, I sat there petrified. You know, God, I'm going to burn forever. And the thing about this, let me tell you something, man, all you men think about it. If you think about it, you've done it. And I got about 13 years old, I began to think about some things. And I knew I was going to burn in hell forever. See, I knew that. I was going to burn in hell forever. And I thought about it a while. I said, well, if you're going to burn in hell forever, you might as well try to do some of it. So anyway, make a long story short, I began to try to do some of it. It's the dangest thing I've seen in my life. God. The lady that I'm married to for many years sitting in the back bed. If I tell you the real story about it all, I might get shot up here, so I'm not going to tell the real story. But had I known anything about alcoholism, my mother had 5 brothers. All 5 of them alcoholic. 4 of them committed suicide. The other one was killed in an automobile wreck because they could not get off alcohol. Nothing about alcoholism. Back in the 30s, early 30s. It's the damnedest disease in the world today. And you think about how fortunate we are today. God has smiled on us sitting in this room here today to find a way to live without drinking liquor. Now, when I came along in the picture, I'll never forget it. Some of you guys will identify with me in corny. They didn't have all this stuff you sniff and the stuff you shoot. They didn't have them. It's stuff to drink. That's all they had. It wasn't none of that other puffing, them cigarettes and all that kind of stuff. I miss that. But when I finished high school, I wanted to go off. I had a lot of ambition. I wanted to be something. I went to the Citadel over in Charleston, South Carolina, and then left there. And after 2 years, went to law school in Atlanta, Georgia. Ida and I started going together, my lovely wife that I'm married to today. Started going together. We went together 5 years before we married, and everybody was against us marrying. Everybody was against it. Her family didn't want me to marry her, and my family didn't want me to marry, and then the whole deal was And by the way, they were right, but we didn't pay any attention to it. We went on in to see them anyway. We went together 7 years, off and on, trying to fight and having one hell of a time. And finally married my senior year in law school. And let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. This lady that I'm married to, I don't know about the rest of you guys, she come from a group of people that lived out there in what they called a Kennedy settlement. They all made liquor and they had big farmers and all this kind of stuff out there. And them Kennedys were bad blood. You never hit a Kennedy, you know. I hear guys in Alcoholics Anonymous say, I got drunk and hit my wife. So I said, liquor would never make me that drunk. Never. I ain't never laid a hand on that woman in my life. Now, we had some incidents occur right after we first got married. I'll tell y'all in a very gentle way. I come in one afternoon from work, was pulling off my clothes to take a bath. And I'd have reached up and pulled out the top dresser drawer and took out a nickel-plated Colt 45. It had 6 bullets in it, cocked it, and pointed it right in my mouth. And said, tell me all about it. And I didn't know which it she was talking about. So my first indication was jump through the window, but that is an excellent shot, still is today. Good, excellent pistol shot. And I knew if I did it, she'd shoot me in the back, so I fell in the floor and began to do some things I've become very good at. I began to cry and to beg and to pray, and I kept saying, don't shoot me, you're going to hurt me. Hell, with a 45 blow a hole in the biggest hand, you know. And I don't know about y'all, but I've faced death many times. And let me tell you something. This is the one incident in my life I saw the whole funeral procession. I saw the casket would be in it. I saw the pallbearers. I saw the whole thing going to the cemetery. I knew I was gone, you know. And the only thing that saved my life, I fell in the floor and began to cry and to beg and to pray. That's the only thing that saved my life. And as I tell you that today, because this woman that I live with, I love her very dearly. But we had one heck of a time in that gal, getting our deal going through. Make a long story short again, I got World War II broke out. While we were first year we married, and our senior law school broke out, and I joined the old Army Air Corps and became a fighter pilot. Early part of the war, I flew P-40s. Old shark nose job. All y'all seen it. It's pretty old. And I transferred into P-47s. Flew those during the war. Drank liquor during the war. No big deal as a result of drinking liquor at this time at all. None at all. You know, I stationed a lot in Kansas. I instructed in Kansas. And Kansas was dry at that time. We'd have to go into Missouri and get some liquor and bring it back. But anyway, we'll make a long story short. I got through that deal. No big deal about it. Came back and got out of service. That's where I run into Cornell. Right after World War II, we both went to work for the federal government, Veterans Administration, as adjudicators. I like that name. That's a big, big title, adjudicators. Judges of claims against the government. We worked up there. Now, they had a bunch of old lawyers that were drunk, and they had a bunch of new ones that couldn't get a job anywhere, see. And that's, me and Cornell was in them young ones that couldn't get a job anywhere, so we went to work for the government. And the thing about it, I'm going to hurt somebody's feeling here, and say, the thing about being a lawyer, you can't tell what you're doing. You're sitting there behind your desk, all these cases come out. Mr. Scott, what's going on? I'm thinking. But the thing about this case here, you can think about it a day, a week, however long you want to think about it. No big deal about it. That's the deal we got involved in. We had some drunks in there, and Cornell remembered one of them, and their name was Rudy. They were getting along, one of the smartest guys we had, and they had an ironclad rule. He fell out of his chair, the fire chief. Rudy fell out of his chair. They fired Rudy. Now, Cornell, at that stage of his alcoholism, he just wouldn't come to work. Cornell had a good secretary, and he'll forget it as long as I live. I'm going to tell you, real easy, and I clean it up. Cornell would be out for a week or two sometime. He'd come back to work. Mr. Foy, oh, we're so sorry. You've been out sick again. Yeah, you know, I got wounded in the war, and I got a plate in my head, and said I've been having a problem. We're so sorry, Mr. Foy, you've been out sick. He pulled this thing off and on for many months, and finally they sent a doctor and a nurse out to his house. And Mr. Foy didn't have the plate in his head. He was laying in the bed drunk. And that took care of Mr. Foy. They asked Mr. Foy, would he leave the government? He left, by the way, and I'm telling part of the story. But anyway, make a long story short, Cornell's the one that got me. I stayed on up there. I was not having any big problem with alcoholism at that time at all. We got jets in 1948 at Dobbins Air Force Base. And I checked out in jets. Having never been in a jet aircraft in my life, they didn't have any two-seaters at that particular time, and I never forget this as long as I live. So I think I had a lot of legitimate reason to drink liquor. It come my day to drink, to fly the damn jet, you know. And I never been in one in my life. And they put me in the jet and struck a match and lit the fire. And they sent a chase plane behind. All this, y'all seen the movies where they sent a chase plane behind a guy who's checking out. And they got things started. No, Patillo's following him. He later made general. And by the way, I didn't make general. They threw me out. But anyway, I got it started. Taxi out in the runway. Patillo followed. I got in. I called the tire and told him I was ready to go. And they turned me over to Patillo. Patillo said, "You ready to go?" I said, "I reckon so." You know, I pushed up to 100%, released the brakes, and down the runway we go to Diamond Air Force Base. About halfway down the runway, this blue smoke began to ball between. I thought, "Oh God, it's on fire!" I pulled off my glove and felt down. It's cold. The damn thing was air conditioned. I didn't know it was air conditioned. I pulled it into the air and took off, and it was such an experience for me. I just sat there and let it go. Ooh. No, Patillo called me in a minute and said, "Collins, you better make a turn. You're already in Alabama." I'm serious. If it wasn't one of the easiest airplanes in the world to fly, ladies and gentlemen, I wouldn't be here today. You can fly a jet just drunk as a cooter now. You can't fly a P-51 or P-47 with a jet. That fire's burning, it'll go. You know, ain't no problem. You just sit there and let her go. I'd set up at 35,000 feet back in. There wasn't nobody up at 35,000 feet. I'd just set up and lay back and let her go. You know, no big deep about it. And most of y'all know, we called back, Korean War broke out in July of 1950, and I was called back on active duty in October the 10th, 1950. They activated a whole squadron of us, World War II boys. All of them married, all of them children, all that thing, and I wound up at Fort Bragg, Fayetteville, North Carolina, up there under Colonel Douglas. I'm breaking his anonym, he's not an alcoholic, but I got it down to Colonel Douglas. We flying all over the countryside, putting on these demonstrations and showing everybody what the aircraft could do and all this kind of stuff. We lived on the base, I and I did, with our children. And Douglas was quite a drunker himself. And I don't know if you've seen him in the movie. I'm sure fighter pilots are crazy bunch of people you've ever been around in life. They have a party. That's the wildest thing you've ever seen. Everybody's drunk, chasing each other's wives, throwing each other in the pool and all kind of mess going on. Douglas gave us a big party over at his house. I was fixing to go to into combat. He gave us a big party, and we was over at the house, everybody drunk, raised, and sand. About 2 o'clock in the morning, Colonel Douglas called me and said, "Collins, can you fly a B-25? I said, "I'm the best B-25 pilot you've ever seen." He said, "Would you take me down to Columbus, Georgia in the morning?" I said, "I'll be glad to." I'd overheard part of the conversation. She come and said, "You can't fly no B-25. I said, "Hell, he's drunk, and I'm drunk. Forget it." The party broke up. We went left about 2 blocks from the colonel. We went home and was in that house getting undressed to go to bed. He drove up across the lawn, that Cadillac, and blowed the horn. "Whoa, whoa, let's go." Put the uniform back on, staggered out. When I got in the car, we drove down the flight line at Pope Field, pulled up in front of operations, and there sat a B-25. Now, I knew what a B-25 looked like. I'd seen a parking where there was one sitting out there. And the sergeant came up and saluted the colonel, said, "The aircraft's ready to go." And fine, he went in and filled out a clearance. We staggered out the airplane. I thought we was playing a game. I said, "Well, we're going back to the officer's club in time to drink some liquor." But we staggered out the airplane. And he said, "You get in." I said, "No, you get in." We argued back to him. I thought, well, this is going as far as I can go. I said, "Listen, I can't fly no damn B-25. He said, "Hell, you said you could. Let's go." I got up and got in the left seat. The sergeant got in the right seat. The colonel lay down in the back seat and passed out. And I started to crank it up. He cranked up and got it turning. I didn't know what to check in a B-25. I've never been in one in my life. So I looked all around, a maze of instruments in them. Some I recognized, some I didn't. I said, "Where does the fuel go?" It said, "All feeds off one main tank right there." I said, "Fine." I called the taxi instructor, and they cleared me out the end of the active runway. And I got out there, and I thought there ought to be a lot to check on a B-25. Isn't a fighter, but I didn't know what to check, so I just caught the brakes on my toes, pushed the throttle all the way forward, and everything went up into the green, as we say in the Air Force. Everything goes up into the green, it means it ought to go. So I called a tire, and they cleared me out on the end of the back of the runway. I poured the coal at B-25, and down the runway we go. And about halfway down the runway, the thought occurred to me, this is a hell of a way to die. I wasn't even excited. This is a hell of a way to die, you know. Going down the runway. I pulled it into the air, and the sergeant cleaned it up. He got the flaps up, the wheels up, and all that stuff. He knew where to get them up. I didn't. He got it all up, and we headed out for Lawson Field. And if you're an alcoholic like I am, now think about this. About an hour out of Pope Field, liquor died out. And it dawned on me that I was the pilot. I'm sitting in the left seat, the sergeant in the right seat. He's not even a pilot. The colonel passed out in the back. We're going through there at 10,000 feet. And I got highly disturbed, to put it mildly. I told that sergeant, I said, go back and get that colonel up and get him up here. How in the hell am I going to get it on the ground? You know, he went back and tried to wake the colonel up. Couldn't get him up. But he come back up, pulled up my headset and said, colonel said, come in over the end runway at about 150 miles an hour. Chop the power and it should land. That's exactly what I did. I made a beautiful landing at B-25. We went to officers club and had three double martinis and blew the damn thing back. That's what alcohol will do for you. I went on overseas. I thought that's the name. Southern part of Japan, Fukuoka. I started flying combat out of Fukuoka. I got over there and I didn't want to fight. I didn't want to be there. Everybody, World War II boy, everybody married and all this stuff. I wasn't all excited about it like World War II. I didn't know what we were fighting. I didn't know why we were over there, really. So I began to fly combat out of Fukuoka, and then we moved from there up into Daegu, south of Seoul down there. Moved up, man. I don't know why y'all know this, not some of y'all do, it's been in the military. The government issues 2 ounces of alcohol each person in combat. If you fly a mission, you come in the big briefing room and sit down and take your pad you got on your knee then. The briefing officer gets to pull down the maps and tell you where you're going, what you're going to do, and what ordnance you're carrying, and all this kind of stuff. It tells you everything. As you come in the briefing room, there's two big coffee urns sitting back there. You come in, you're supposed to get a cup of coffee and sit down and do this. Now, I don't know if it's in the coffee urn or not. I've never seen anybody drinking, but this is the process yet. We take all this stuff down, and you go fly your missions, you come back, supposed to get a double shot of bourbon and a debrief. That's the process. Some of y'all have seen this in the movie. Now, I had already had about 4 shots before I got over to the briefing, and then as I come out there, I'd get me another double shot before I got in the F-84 and go north into Korea. Drop those 2 1,000-pound bombs, get rid of the rockets, get rid of the napalm, and try to stay alive. I lied a lot about what all I did in combat when I came back. Ladies and gentlemen, I didn't even try to shoot nobody unless he got in my damn way of me trying to get the hell out of there. That's the only people I shot at, you know. It was the darnest thing I've ever seen in my life. We had a guy that slept 2 bunks below me. He had 5 children. I saw him get killed in downtown, went in right in the middle of Pyongyang in North Korea. We left here with 75 pilots. We killed 37 of them the first 8 months in combat. I got a lot of feelings about the Korean conflict. I drank liquor day and night. Get up in the morning, take a drink of liquor. Right in, I got pictures all right in the barracks there where we had a little bar built in the barracks. Drank liquor. Every person over there was drinking liquor all the time. I've seen guys so drunk they couldn't get in the F-84. I've seen them pick them up and set them in there and buckle them in, hit the start button, and let them go. That's the kind of deal we had going on over there. It was the dangest thing I've seen in my life. And that's just what I went through. Ida would write me every day a letter, and I wouldn't even read them. I didn't want to read them and don't hear anything about it. I kept drinking liquor. Finally, I began to hemorrhage some from the nose, flying so much altitude. I began to bleed, and they were going to send me back from Korea to Nagoya, Japan, to be operated on to stop the bleeding. Had a man by the name of Father Ford from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'll never forget him as long as I live. Catholic priest, Father Ford. They were going to send me back. Now, listen to what I'm fixing here. They're going to send me back from Korea to Japan to be operated. And I went to see Father Ford. I said, listen, I'm going over Nagoya to be operated. You know the Catholic priest over at the hospital? He said, I don't never even heard of Nagoya. I don't know about it over there. I said, would you call over there, see who the Catholic priest is in that hospital, and get him to bring me some liquor once I get in the hospital? So he called over there, got the priest on the phone, said, I'm sending a Lieutenant Collins over there to be operated on. Says he's a Baptist and a hopeless case. Don't try to convert him, but bring him some liquor. The day I checked in the hospital, this major with that crossover came in. He brought me a fifth of liquor every day I was in the hospital. And I think about this, ladies and gentlemen, thought about it many times. I'd have gone into DTs in a matter of 24 hours had I not had it. But he brought me a fifth of liquor every day. And I drank a fifth every day and got through the operation. Finished my tour in Korea, came back home. Had a son, C.D. III, born while I was over in Korea. Got back home. Caught a plane from San Francisco to Savannah, Georgia. Ida and the two little girls met me down there. And I'd left the States weighing 127 pounds. I now weighed 185. Had a great big handlebar mustache. It curled right up on my eye. I could look straight out and see my cheeks. And when I got off the airplane, Ida and them didn't recognize me. And didn't want. And when I told them who it was, they didn't want to kiss me. And I'd been in the war. And on the way home, I stopped and got a fifth of liquor. The liquor store was still open. I got a fifth of liquor. And I was drunk the first time I laid eyes on my son, C.D. III. just the way it was. I went back to Atlanta, Georgia. I had an idea. Went back to work with the federal government. An adjudicator. Left the house every morning taking a drink of liquor with me. So I got in the car to go to work. Drank on the job. Didn't have no problem with that. But Ida began to have a problem with CD. And the kind of problem I'm talking about doesn't make good telling. She began to have bad problems with me. About me not coming home, not doing what I'm supposed to do, lying, and all this kind of stuff that went on. Finally, she got enough of it. She loaded up her children in Marietta, Georgia, which is right out of the edge of Atlanta, and moved to Statesboro, Georgia, and divorced me for habitual drunkenness. And if you're ever in a courthouse in Statesboro, you can read about C.D. Collins. I'm not anonymous. It says in there that I'm a drunkard right on the official record in this courthouse. So she divorced me, left me in Atlanta. Now, if you're an alcoholic, you need a wife, or somebody to look after you. Get your clothes clean, take a bath, shave. You know, these simple things we don't think nothing about. You need one. And I began to have a lot of problems up in Atlanta, Georgia. So I left Atlanta, went over to Birmingham, Alabama over there. Got over at Louis' Grill right across from the Social Security office over there, and went over and established credit with Louis. I told him, I said, all my funds are tied up. How about a little credit? He said, you can have anything you want, Mr. Collins, with your job. Make a long story short again, none of y'all have ever done this bad. I tipped all the waitresses a dollar every time the first waiter. That's way back when a dollar was a dollar. Anyway, I go over at 10 o'clock. All government employees get a break at 10 o'clock, coffee break. You go over and sit around this huge oak table, all us lawyers. It's set a cup of coffee on there with a cream on the side and a spoon. But in mine, it put straight bourbon in it. It have the cream in it. And the thing you got to remember about it is blow it like it's hot. Sip it. I'd get a double shot of bourbon at 10 o'clock, none at 12, none at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd come in at 5 and pick up a half a pint of Seagram's VO, cost $2.20. Never forget that figure as long as I live. And go home, drunk. At the end of 8 months, I owed Louis over $12,000 for damn liquor. Now listen to me again. The good Lord intervened in my life. I don't know about you alcoholics, John Mooney, and all of y'all have heard this. Trouble began to happen. I'm in my office one day, and two men walked in and told my secretary, said, we'd like to see Mr. Collins. Finally, came and said, Mr. Collins, would you ride downtown with us? I said, I'll be glad to. I said, evidently I have some little local case down you don't want me to look at. So we go out and get in a plain black Ford and drive downtown in the middle of Birmingham, Alabama. Pull up in front of this huge gray building. We all get out. We stepped out and I looked and says, Birmingham Jail. I screamed like a stuck hog. Ah, the guy picked me. Walked right in the door. Now, none of y'all have ever been locked up, but it's a very, very traumatic thing. They put me in a bullpen by 100 other guys. I got a coat and tie on, just locked me in. And locked the thing. Now, let me ask you, any of you ever been in jail? First question, they locked me, walked off jail. Somebody said, boy, what are you in for? I said, the warrant said child support. They said, judge, give you 5 years on the chain gang for that year in Birmingham. I'd like to die right then. I could see that. A professional bondman came down and bail me out. I never did go back to my office. I went home to Mom and Daddy. Now, Mama said the reason I drank liquor is called to live without her. Now, I'd have done moved to Statesboro, Georgia and divorced old C.D. Collins for habitual drunkenness. I'd go home to Mom and Daddy. Now, some of y'all have experienced this. I'm with Mom and Daddy, and I come to one morning in the bed over there, and I hear my Mama talking to my daddy in the other bedroom. She said, Clifford, load him up in that car and carry him to Statesboro, Georgia, and whatever it takes, you get Ida to take him back. Because she's the only damn one mean enough to live with him. So my daddy loaded me up in the car and brought me down to Statesboro, Georgia to see this woman. And some of you got to be even south to understand the next mark. When she saw me, it's like pouring turpentine on a cat. She just jump up and down, you know. And saying all these words to my daddy and describing me with a lot of adjectives to my daddy. And some of y'all heard this hit boy down a money transaction. I sat in her dining room in her house there, around the dining room table for a week. Her and my daddy negotiated about money. He paid her to remarry me. I tell you, I'm serious. I told her this. I said, I'm never going to hit another damn lick of work as long as I live. When you put me on jail over yonder, I'm never going to. If you're going to put me on the chain gang, I want to be on the chain gang here in Statesboro when I come out of that truck every day and wait my youngin. So my daddy paid her to remarry. She said, well, he didn't pay me enough. I said, I didn't have to do it. Y'all didn't let me say a word about it. Y'all just negotiated there for a week about the money, and you finally said, I'll remarry me. She described a lot of adjectives in the words she used. You got to be from south to understand this. And you're sorry as hell. I said, I may be an SOB, but I am not sorry. That's the worst word you can call it. So we remarried. Wasn't going to ever drink again because we knew liquor was a problem. Stayed sober about 3 months. One night we decided to have a drink at a dinner. That started the whole thing going again, ladies and gentlemen. We know that now, a lot about it. And I went down the tube real fast. I got back into it. This time, wide open, wide open. I began to drink liquor day and night, charge liquor, do anything in the world in order to continue drinking. And everything went down the tube real fast for me and this woman I love very dearly. Got into the point, and like Cornelius was telling you, and I'm serious about it, he knows the truth about this. I got down to where I get dead dog drunk where I couldn't get up. And you tell me about in the woods one day, I had a job with the State Highway Department. I had to supervise some construction. And I could drink on the job as long as I didn't let nobody get close to him. But one day the boss come on the job, and I went out in the woods with a fifth of liquor to sit down. You know, while the boss was there, and he finally left, I got in the wood, and I sat and kept drinking the liquor, and then I couldn't get up. I don't know what you've ever done. I crawl around on my all fours like a hog about half a day trying to get up, and I couldn't get up. You can't say, aren't I having a good time? You know, isn't this nice? You know? On all fours like a hog. That's the way it was, you know. And it got to the point that I no longer could make it. I wanted out, and I didn't know any way out. I knew no way out, and I wanted out. The woman that I love very dearly was going to divorce me again. We read in the Atlanta Journal about a treatment center opening in Atlanta, Georgia, out on Barcliff Road, over A.C. Candler home there. And I wanted to go, and she called my mother, and they came down and got me and took me to Atlanta, Georgia. And I went into this place there, went through this treatment center there in Atlanta, Georgia, and found out I was an alcoholic, and I could stay sober if I'd be willing to do certain things. And tell you here and now I got involved, I wanted out. And I didn't know, when I went off of treatment, I'm serious, I didn't know where to put you in maybe a rubber sheet, beat you with holes and squirted you with water, what they did, I don't know. But I didn't care what they did, I wanted out. I was ashamed and embarrassed. I was paranoid. I couldn't walk the streets of Statesboro, Georgia. When I come to banks, I'd go in the alley to keep them going around in front of the bank. I'd afraid they'd run out and catch me because I wrote so many bad checks. And everybody was talking about CD, you know. It's the greatest thing I've seen in my life. But I came out of that treatment center and came back home, and I had filed for the second divorce. Told me I'd ever come back to Statesboro, Georgia, but like most alcoholics, I had to come back down and see what I could do. And I come back down and stayed in the basement hotel, paid $5 a week for a room, basement hotel there. Got a job cutting grass for $295 a month. And I didn't have no car. I have all my clothes in a cloth bag. My daddy had cut me completely loose. He said, I don't intend to give you another nickel. I'm not helping you, son. I'm hurting you. He turned me loose, too. Had all my clothes in a cloth bag and cutting grass, $295 a month. And I'd go by to see the children. Ida said she saw a change in me. There was no AA in Statesboro, Georgia. The only groups in was in Savannah, Georgia, and Augusta, Georgia, and Dublin. Tried to get an AA started, couldn't go, and we began to try to go back to the Savannah. I ran into Cornelius, and I never forget the first meeting we had up there. About four or five of us up there. Cornelius came in and saw me and said, you, Collins? I said, yeah, me, you know, drunk too, you know. But they would come back into and help us, and I thank God today the fact that we're willing to help one another. That's what this thing is all about, ladies and gentlemen. That's the reason I'm here today, is to pass it on to my fellow man, fellow woman, tell you that you can stay sober if you're willing to do certain things. And to tell you again, I've been around a lot, it's like Cornell, a long time. I've seen a world of people who didn't make it. And I've seen a world of people who refuse, say, well, I'm not going to do that, or that doesn't apply for me, all that kind of stuff, you know. Some of y'all know that. I attend five or six meetings a week. I sit with a group. And let me tell you another thing about you ladies. I got this, man. Forgot about this. I joined Al-Anon, you know, and for 2 years she was in Al-Anon. And long story short, she's in the Alcoholics Anonymous now. We have four children, two of those in AA, and the other two won't drink. I try to insist they drink a little, but they won't, so ain't nothing I can do about it. Two of them in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my wife's in AA, and after 2 years she's going to join AA. And I come in one afternoon with Doug and Jordan Bennett. She said, I'm going to join an alcoholic. And I said, hell no, you're not. There ain't no why mine going to be an alcoholic. There wasn't many of you women around back then. We had one in Dublin, Jordan. They weighed about 300 pounds and had no teeth. And her hair stuck straight up. She slept in the AA club room. And my wife's going to join that group. I said, no, you're not, you know. But to make a long story short again, ladies, we sat down and talked all night long. And she told me what went on the inside here. I said, yeah, you belong in AA. She came in Alcoholics Anonymous. She's been sober ever since. Thank God for that today. We both have a way to live and have a relationship that we never would have had. And to tell you here now, it's going to sound crazy to you. See, I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. I found a way to live. I'm okay with C.D. Collins today, and I have been for a long time. When I was out there drinking liquor, like my friend over there, I didn't know who I was. If I was with you and you were a preacher, I'd preach a little. If I was you and you were a hell raiser, I'd raise hell. I'd want to fit in wherever I did. You're talking about money, then I want to impress you with money, whatever, you know. But today I know who I am today, and I thank God for it today that I'm a member of this fellowship. I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. I'm sorry for what happened back there, but I'm glad I found a way to live. Because I found a God in Alcoholics Anonymous that I never found in my Baptist church, and I still go to church and Sunday school every Sunday. I found a way to live today, and I'm comfortable with today. I can look anybody in the eye. I'm as good as you are. I'm not better than, but good as. And I thank God for what it's done for me and my family. I have a relationship. I gave my son, C.D. the Third, his white chip. And when I handed it to him, I said, I wouldn't take $1 million for what I'm doing. And he's the one that the doctors called me and his mom and said, this boy's not going to make it. I'm going to lose him. He's been sober 15 years. Now he's married. He's a professional man. He's one of our leading citizens in our town today by reason of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. In Statesboro, Georgia, it's a status symbol of being able to do anything else. So if you ever done it. Someone said, how do I find you? I said, ask the police. They'll tell you, ain't no problem about how to find us. But to tell you that I have found a way to live, it blows my mind today, because what I do, what I did before I came down here, I got on my knees and asked the good Lord to put the words in my mouth. I know not right now that I will not say what I plan to say, but this is the way it's coming out. I asked God to put the words in my mouth. And if I touch one individual in this audience, that old CD has done okay. It's been worth the trip to come up here and do the whole bit. That's what it's all about. I'm still doing today what they started, Cornel and Bob Fowler started back years ago with us. It's helping my fellow man on a daily basis. And to tell you, you know, that you can get sober and stay sober if you're willing to do what it says to. And the thing, the irony of it all again in our hometown, I come down the street about 3 months ago, and I counted 14 people that died down that one street since I've been sober for alcoholism and drug addiction. Most of it's dual addiction now. You run into the alcohol and drugs. I don't know where you're. Most of them are doing both things now. But 14 people down this one street have died since I've been around. Result of alcoholism and drug addiction. And there's another young man in the group that says, Daddy's a multimillionaire, fixing to die on drugs. Refuses to do anything, refuses to take any action about the boy. You know, then won't do it. And the thing that we all know, sometime down the line, you have to take some action. You don't get to do something for somebody. That's what we had to do in our own family, had to take some action about ours and our family. And the woman that's sitting back here in the back that I love very dearly, that hated the ground I walked on, started to blow my brains out. I have a relationship with her. I wouldn't take $1 million for it today. We don't play any games or anything. We tell each other the truth about whatever. No lying about anything. She asked me a question, I'm going to tell her the truth. No game playing at all anymore. I lost my commission in the Air Force flying a woman when I and I were divorced. I took a woman up in a T-33 jet one Sunday, and anyway, make a long story short, I couldn't sign the clearance, and they turned it into the colonel. And he called me and said, was you drinking? I said, yes, sir. Not my outfit. I'm on court-martial. I said, I flew 100 missions drinking. I don't know why come I can't fly. Not here drinking. He said, not here. But he let me resign my commission. And the reason I tell you this, I resigned my commission, got out of the Air Force altogether. And I got sober and got it all back. I went to Washington, D.C., talked to a four-star general, told him my story. I'd been sober 5 years. Told him my story. Said, go back, Mr. Connors, and reapply. And let me fly out. I was 60 years old. Flew to 60. And by the way, I'm still flying today. I have an acrobatic airplane. There's a fly over town upside down. They get mad in hell about that. They preferred charges against me 4 or 5 times, and I've got very friendly with the FAA man in Atlanta, Georgia. We've talked quite a bit, and last time we talked every afternoon for a week. He said, Mr. Connor, I'm not going to do anything to you. You know what you're doing. I said, well, I got an airplane designed to do acrobatics. It's got inverted fuel, inverted oil, and it's designed to fly upside down. You know, go. So they released me now for the time being. I don't know whether to get back after me or not, but I still got it, and I love to do acrobatics. I love to fly airplanes. And I went through helicopter school when I was 53 years old, and I thought I was crazy, and I was. But anyway, I went through helicopter school and learned to fly helicopters. And to tell you this one thing, the greatest freedom in the world is being chemically free, being off the stuff. Greatest freedom in the world. I tell young people coming on board, and I see some every day. I sit in the room every morning, 11:30, with about 18 women, 10 or 12 men, young men. And I say, you got the greatest freedom in the world. You got a chance. You can go back to school. You can change your profession. You can do whatever you want to do. You stay off the stuff. Last time I was in college, I was 53 years old, University of Southern California. They thought I was crazy as hell, and what? But anyway, they asked me, how old are you? I thought it looked like everybody. How old are you? Who? He said, you. I said, 53. He said, what in the hell are you doing here? I said, I'm going to school. He said, you must be crazy. I said, I am. You know, it's okay. But the point is, I wanted to go back and go through this program. I had out there in the University of Southern California. And that's the freedom you got if you're involved in this recovery program and you're sober. You got the greatest freedom in the world. I came off the cutting grass to the deal. I wound up as an engineer with the Department of Transportation. Got that. Got a commercial pilot, an appraiser, the whole deal. I got it all back. Thank God again. And to tell you, all of you who are here, you're new in the program, for God's sakes, hang in here. Do what it says. In the beginning, let me say in the beginning, I attended these meetings and I didn't buy what y'all were saying either. We come out of these meetings, I said, that's a large bunch of people all laughing and carrying on. They've had my problem, they would be laughing, you know. But I come into this deal here and found a way to live. And I had a relationship with my wife and my children and my fellow man that I never would have had I not been an alcoholic. I thank God today that I have found a way to live on a daily basis. Still one day at a time. And the reason I'm here is because I was asked to come. I'm still doing what I've asked to do on a daily basis. This man is too, help the world of people. And to tell you all, for God's sakes, hang in here on a daily basis in the portion of chapter 5 that we read every day. Tom Power helped write the big book. I know Tom. I know where you know him or not. Tom Power. All right. But anyway, he's one of the finest fellows I've ever met. A brilliant man. He said the program works on all conditions. If you do what it says do, you will stay sober. Period. Now, you might be miserable as hell since I've been sober. We've had death in the family, money trouble, job trouble, child trouble. We've had it all since being sober. But I've never entertained the idea, well, I believe I'll go get drunk or I need a drink of liquor. That's never occurred to me. Never occurred to me in the 41 years to go back to that. Never. I've been a hell of a time at times with some of the children, some of their problems. But I and I have found a way to live on a daily basis. And to tell you, if you do what it says do, you too will find what I found. Now, the one thing that I know, again, I had a lot of ambition. I wanted to be governor of the state of Georgia. Had the connection one time to be governor. Me and I had found a letter of him a few months ago looking through some stuff. Ellis Arnold, where he wanted to appoint me attorney general when I come back to Korea. But I come back a drunk, so I missed that deal. But to make a long story short again, I'd rather be doing what I'm doing today than be governor of the state of Georgia. Now, you might not be governor of the state of Georgia, because I have a way to live where I'm comfortable with C.D. Collins today. And to tell you, that's what you can find in this program. It's a way to live. Well, you're okay with you. And if you're okay with you, then you're okay. I can look anybody in the eye. Now, to tell you again, that I'd rather be involved in this program than have a statue erected to me on the Capitol Square in Atlanta, Georgia. Because being in this program, pass on to my fellow man what I found is one of the greatest privileges in the world today for a human being. Say, hey, you can get sober. I'm still going, making 12-step call, doing what I'm supposed to do right on a daily basis. And to tell y'all that I found the real meaning of love in Alcoholics Anonymous. The most used and the misused and abused word in the English language is love, L-O-V-E, love. I love a dog, I love a cat, I love a house, love, 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 love. The real meaning of love is love another human being without asking anything in return. And that's what I found in this program. Thank you very much for listening.